Hello, and welcome to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Monger. He's the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Calvary Chapel. At Light the Way, we believe the most powerful tool we possess when sharing our faith with others is the Word of God. It was the Apostle Paul that said, "Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of Christ." So as we open the Word together, it's our prayer that you'll not only receive what God has for you, but share what you learn with those you come in contact with. And now, here's Pastor Colin.
And for right now, if I could ask you to join me by turning in your Bible to Matthew chapter 24. If you don't have one, there's one in the seat back in front of you. That's the same version that I use. Matthew 24. 39 years ago, in 1984, a man by the name of Arnold Schwarzenegger would change the world with three little words: "I'll be back." You know exactly what I mean. When he said those words in that movie, they became an instant cultural staple. And people say them and joke about them, but we all know where they come from. We know who they said it or who said it. And whenever we repeat it, we try to do it in the best Arnold voice we can. "I'll be back." I don't know how that sounds, but that's mine. I don't know what yours sounds like. I was thinking about that this week because 2,000 years before Arnold said those words, Jesus Christ said those words. He said, "I'll be back." And actually, to quote him, he said, "If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again. And I'll take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also." And for the past 2,000 years, we, the church, have been waiting for that to happen. For the past couple of years, we've been in this series. It's called Harmony, looking at the life and the ministry of Jesus Christ. And we've been talking about everything that he's done from his birth. We started this series at Christmas time of 2020, and it's followed Jesus all through his life, his ministry, his ups, his downs, his struggles, his triumphs. And now we're approaching the end. In fact, rapidly approaching the end. In fact, where we are in the gospel in Matthew 24 at this very moment is the final week of Jesus' life. It's called Passion Week, or some people call it Holy Week. It's that Easter week that we usually celebrate in the springtime. It's between triumphal entries, Palm Sunday, and Easter Sunday, Resurrection Sunday, and that's where we find ourselves here. This is Tuesday, maybe it's Wednesday. It's a little blurry on these 2 days. A lot of the others are very clear, but here we're right in the middle of that final week, which means that Jesus is just a couple of days away from the cross, and he knows it. He knows that he has hours left. Only a few times left to tell his disciples something that they're going to live on. And so he starts talking about things that will come later, things that happen after he dies, after he returns, after he ascends. What can they expect to see in the world after all of this? So he started this chapter talking about the signs of the end times, and he was discussing things like wars and rumors of wars and nations rising against nation and the love of many growing cold. And he told us back in verse 6, "See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet." Then the rapture of the church happens in verse 13. He says, "Who endures to the end will be saved," followed by the first half of the tribulation in verse 14, where he says the gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed, and then the end will come. Then we have the abomination of desolation in verse 15. It's the middle ground. It's the midway point, the halftime show of this whole thing. Following that is the second half of the tribulation. Jesus himself calls it the great tribulation in verse 21, which means everything from verse 13 to verse 28 happens over a period of 7 years. In Revelation 11, it says two witnesses, this is the first half of the tribulation, will prophesy for 1,260 days. If you do the math, that's 3.5 years. And at the end of that, it says the beast will rise up and kill them. Then we read in the book of Daniel, chapter 9, from the time that the offering is stopped and the abomination happens, from that time forward, it says there's 1,290 days. Well, if you do the math, that's 7 years and 30 days. That's an extra month. So what happens during that month? Well, the Bible doesn't actually tell us. Some people think that it's a kind of rebuilding time for Israel after the tribulation. Others, myself included, tend to think that this may be the time in between the rapture and the signing of the treaty between Israel and the Antichrist. There's going to be a time where people are wondering what's going on. Everyone's disappeared and the believers are gone. The church is gone. It turns out a lot of this stuff is right and there's mass chaos in the world. Someone rises to prominence and all of that. That's going to take a little bit of time. And so there's an extra little bit of wiggle room in there. There's a buffer period. But then when it starts, it is exactly 7 years. From verse 13 to verse 28, 7 years have gone by. Following that, Jesus returns to the earth. Only he comes back not as the lamb, but as a lion. And he doesn't return alone. He comes back with the armies of heaven, including the entirety of the church. That's you and me and the complete and total number of believers of all time. And when that happens, the millennial kingdom will begin. That's 1,000 years of peace on earth. That's 1,000 years of not having to lock your car door at night. That's 1,000 years of no bad news in the news. That's 1,000 years where the courts and the jails are put out of business and the police aren't needed. That's 1,000 years of harmony. Satan is thrown into a bottomless pit. It is that period of time that Isaiah talks about when he says in Isaiah 11 that the wolf will lay down with the lamb. And the leopard and the young goat will lay down together. And the calf and the lion and the fatted calf will lay down together. It all starts with the second coming of Jesus. All that brings us to the first thing I want to talk about this morning. When that happens, when Jesus returns to this earth, it will be unmistakable. Notice what it says beginning in verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in the heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. You know, one of the most common things people do with passages like this, these supernatural events of God in life, anytime God moves in our life, anytime something unexplainable happens, you know what they try to do? Explain it. And they try to find some rational, scientific, logical reason for something supernatural that's occurred. And they say, well, it's got to be something else. It's got to be anything else. There's a reason this happened. It's not that. There's a way that we can answer it. We just need to understand it a little bit better. For example, when the great flood happened and Noah and his family were saved with two of each animal inside the ark, and they were there, that God shut them in. You know, there's a lot of people who say, well, that was just a myth, that there's no evidence for that in the world, except for the fact that you have fish remains in mountains higher than birds fly. That's a hard thing to reconcile with the idea that this never happened, but there are those who say that. Or some people will say, well, it did happen, but it wasn't the whole world, you see. And they'll say, well, Noah didn't know about Great Britain, and he didn't know about Canada, North America, and Central and South America, and Hawaii. He didn't know about Russia and Japan, and he didn't know about Australia. And so wherever he was, there was a big flood, and it was all of his world, but he didn't know about the whole globe, and so probably that's what it was, except for the fact that ancient religions, even in South America, write about a great flood, and Australia, and Japan, and China. But there are those who say that's what it was. When it comes to Israel crossing the Red Sea, there's a lot of people who have a hard time with the idea that God supernaturally divided the water. And they want to say anything and everything else. Things like, well, it could have been a receding tide, you see, and it happens a couple times a year where the sea kind of drops away, and it must have been just as Israel was getting to the shore that this thing happened, and they walked across, and then it came in right behind them, and they were smeared. Or they'll say that we, for all of these years, have been misreading the Bible. That Moses didn't actually cross there, that is a misunderstanding of the ancient text, that instead he crossed at a place called the Reed Sea. And it was only 18 inches deep, and it had tall grass, and Moses kind of parted the grass as he went through, and they wrote about it, and it became a legend. Well, that's a hard thing to square with the fact that the whole Egyptian army was drowned in then 18 inches of water. That's a bigger miracle if you ask me. But there are those who will say things like that. Or even when Jesus walked on water in the middle of the Sea of Galilee in the midst of the storm, they'll say, well, he really wasn't walking on water. It was an illusion. What it was because of the storm, the sand had shifted, and he was walking on a sandbar, and that's what the disciples saw. You've seen a sandbar. They exist in the ocean. And that is true, except for the fact that they were in the middle of the Sea of Galilee at the deepest point. So that must have been one incredible sandbar. I was reading an article just this past week talking about Moses and the burning bush and saying, well, that bush was an acacia tree, which probably was. And it was sitting on an active volcanic vent on Mount Sinai because, geologically speaking, and this is true, Mount Sinai was a volcano. It's dormant now, so this person theorized that, well, this bush was on one of those vents and it caught fire, and that's what Moses saw. Okay, except it tells us in the account that it wasn't consumed. So I don't know how you square those two things, but that's what that person says. Another person was talking about the sacrifice that Elijah made and how he doused his offering with water and poured water all over the altar and said, my God is going to take this offering and not this pagan offering over here. And then supernaturally, Elijah's sacrifice was consumed with fire. And this person says, well, probably what that was a lightning bolt. Because there was a cloud on the horizon in the narrative, and that must have been a storm cloud, which makes sense, they postulated, because now this thing is covered in water, which makes it a great conductor, and lightning bolts can go for miles and miles, and it hit this thing. Except for the fact that you, as a person, have a 1 in 15,000 chance of being hit by lightning in life. And then you add in the fact that he said when and where and how, and it happened right there on that altar while they were standing there, and the odds of that are virtually impossible. But the person says that must be what it was. Those same people are quick to point out how ancient people didn't know about things like epilepsy and comas and microbiology. And so they would say things like stories of possession. Well, that's just epilepsy. That people who were resurrected, they're just coming out of a coma. Forgetting the fact that these same people built things like the roads for the Roman Empire that still exist today. And aqueducts that changed civilization. And buildings that still stand. And pyramids that no one can figure out how to do it again. And ships that navigated the sea without maps or GPS or anything like that. They say, yeah, but they must not have understood when a person was really dead. Those same people, even now, will say, Jesus said wars and disease and persecution and political issues. But you know, that's all been happening for a long time. And to that, they're right, it has been. Did you know that of all of human history, 92% of all of it has been filled with war? Only 8% of the time has the world been at peace. And so, yes, there has always been war. The first two people, the first two people sinned, their children, one of them killed the other. So violence and murder and killing and war has been around a long time. And these folks will then say, that doesn't mean it's the end times from the Bible. They'll look at an earthquake or a natural disaster. They'll look at the fact that a hurricane just struck the deserts of the United States. And they'll say, well, that's climate change. The magnetic poles have shifted. That was that comet that went by that one time. That's because you're not driving enough electric cars. Did you know that? But notice what Jesus says. Verse 30. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and all the tribes of earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. This will be a globally recognizable event. No one's going to look at this and go, climate change. You see all that happening up there? That's all because of all those beef farms in the Midwest and all the methane they're producing. That's why this is happening. No one's going to look at this and say it's a government conspiracy or fake news. No one's going to mistake this for a solar flare or the poles shifting from the magnetic poles of the world or some other natural phenomenon. When Jesus returns, he said in verse 27, as lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of man. You're not going to need to read this on social media. You're going to see it. It doesn't matter where you are in the world, you're going to see it. There's not going to be a rumor. Hey, did you hear Jesus came back? No, I didn't get that one. Can you tell me more about it? There's not going to be any question. There's not going to be any doubt. This will be unmistakable. The second thing it will be is universal. Notice in verse 30, all the tribes of earth, it says, will mourn. Notice in verse 31, he says, he will gather his elect from the four winds, one end of heaven to the other. This is not a local issue. It's not an American issue. It's not a European issue. This is not a government issue. It's not a social issue. It's not a racial issue. It doesn't matter where you live. Every man, woman, and child will experience the return of Christ. For some people, it will be a day of justification and justice. For other people, it'll be a day of judgment. But every person in the world at that time will be affected. In the book of Philippians, Paul says, at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow, and every tongue will confess. And when that happens, it's not going to matter whether a person agreed with this or not, whether this affirmed a lifestyle choice or whether they believed in it. It's not going to matter what race they were, what gender or nationality, what level of education or income or ethnicity. None of that's going to matter. Their religion's not going to matter. Their mistakes in life aren't going to matter. Every tribe of the earth, from one end of heaven to the other, it says, this is a universal event. You see, at some point, every single person, and this is what this is pointing us to, every single person will have to answer the question, what are you doing about Jesus Christ in your life? Now, some will mock him. They'll trivialize him. They'll make jokes at his expense. Others will oppose him, some violently. They'll try and take his name out of social dialogue and off buildings and out of courtrooms and out of legal legislation and out of anything and everything of the public sphere. You know, Pontius Pilate had to deal with this question. In fact, he was dealing with this question, and he formed the question. He says later in chapter 27, after the crowd brings Jesus to him, he says, what shall I do with Jesus, who is called the Christ? The crowd said, crucify him, and some will do that as well. In their heart, they'll kill any idea of Jesus, and yet others will receive him and accept him and embrace him. But at a certain point, everyone will have to make the decision. What are you doing about Jesus Christ? Now, that decision day might not be today. For you, it might not be tomorrow, but it could be. Jesus said in verse 36, concerning that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven or the Son, but the Father only. So we don't know when it will happen, but one thing is for sure, it will happen. In verse 30, it says, all the tribes will mourn. Verse 31, it says, from one end of heaven to the other. It says, the four winds, the four corners of the world, in other words. And when it does, it will affect everyone. It will be universal. Third, it will be undeniable. Notice in verse 30 what he says. All the tribes of earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. When this all happens, the whole world will recognize this is Jesus Christ. And by that time, 3.5 years of preaching will have gone by. Just imagine at this moment in human history what will have transpired over the previous 7 years. For the first half of that, 144,000 preachers have gone out into the world. Mass conversions have been occurring. All of them are sharing with their family. Two witnesses from heaven have come down and prophesied for that time. An angel has gone around the entire globe and preached in every language. It says in verse 14, the gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. By the time this happens, all of that has occurred. And so no one will be able to say, I didn't know. I didn't hear. I didn't know that was coming. And that's going to be a problem because we love the I don't know answer. I didn't know I was going that fast, officer. Honest. Scout's honor. I had no idea I was doing 60 in a 10. I didn't see that stop sign, that cat. Just kidding. Get into an argument with our spouse. Well, I didn't know we had plans for that night. Oh, it's been on the calendar. I texted you. I emailed you. It's been everywhere. We talked about it last week. Oh, but I didn't know. I didn't know that bothered you. I didn't know that's what you meant when you said this. All of our kids are heading back to school. I wonder how long it takes. I really do sometimes before the teachers start hearing, I didn't know that was due today. I didn't know about that test. I didn't know we were going to have that project. I don't know what happened to my homework teacher. Honestly, it was in my backpack this morning. It must have been beamed out with Pastor Charles in the mystery box video. It was right here. You know, in the law, that's called plausible deniability. And it means that a person isn't culpable because they didn't know. Politicians love it. Defense attorneys love it. Because if you didn't know, if you don't have something in the law called a mens rea, that means a guilty mind, one that understands what it is that you've done, then you can't be held responsible. But here's the thing about the second coming of Jesus. Everyone will know. Jesus even said here in verse 25, see, I have told you. So when these things happen, no one will be able to say, I didn't know. I had no idea that's what this meant. It says here in verse 30, all the tribes of earth will mourn. What are they mourning? They're mourning the fact that it was real. That the stuff they said no to was real. The stuff they mocked was real. The stuff they canceled from the culture was real. Millions of people are gone. It turns out this was right. And here comes Jesus, and they know who he is. And so it will be undeniable. Fourth, it's unavoidable. Remember, in this chapter alone, 42 times, we see the word will. This will happen. That will happen. Then this thing will happen. Not if, but will happen. It's not opinion. It's a fact. It's not a theory. It's a certainty. Notice in verse 32, he goes on. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. Aren't you glad you're not a fig tree, by the way? Jesus, didn't like them, I think. But from the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. In the book of Revelation, it says, write these things that must soon take place. Later on, at the very end of the book, it says, I am coming soon. I mention those verses with this one because over the years, a lot of people have had a hard time with them. Because it doesn't seem to be very soon, does it? Jesus said this generation won't pass away before it happens, but they're all dead. The apostles are gone. Their children, their grandchildren, their great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren, they're all gone. And it hasn't happened yet. He said soon, and yet it hasn't happened yet. It's been 2,000 years since those words were written, and we're still waiting. Here's the thing, and I want to let you in on a little secret, just in case you didn't know this. The Bible wasn't written in English. Don't tell anybody, but it wasn't. What translates soon to us in the original language means rapid, means quickly. When these things happen, they will happen quickly, rapidly. They will progress one after the next after the next. It will be no stopping them. And so when Jesus says in verse 15, for example, when you see the abomination of desolation, he's talking to that future reader that's there at that time. Here he's talking to them too. To the generation that sees this thing start, it's gonna have to play out to the end. You're not gonna get out of this. There's no way to derail it. You're not gonna stop it. That generation will endure and live through every moment of the things to come. We don't know when it will happen, but when it starts, that generation will experience it all. And so not only does Jesus start telling us about things that will happen, now he's telling us about to whom it will happen. To that generation. They're going to live through all of it. They're going to wake up every single day, and that's going to be reality. And it will happen. Not if, but when. The Bible says the purposes of the Lord will stand. In the book of Job, it says, I know that you are the one who does all things, and no purpose of yours will be thwarted. When God tells us about something that's going to happen in the future, understand he's not talking about his future. He's talking about his past. Did you ever notice in the Old Testament when God was talking to Israel and Abraham and all of that group, you know what he said? I have given you the land of Canaan. Go into the land that I have given you. Well, that's a weird thing to say to people that have never been in it, that he's already given it to them, because to God, it is a past tense, it is a future history. To us, it hasn't happened. To him, it is established truth. And it doesn't matter if it's accepted or not, or believed or not. This is God's plan for the future of this world, and there is no avoiding it. We can't ignore it. We can't hope it's not going to happen. We can't turn the channel and take our mind off of it. We can't say, well, that's great for you, but that's not my future. That's not my truth. It's for you. It's not for me. It's unavoidable. It's also unpredictable. Notice in verse 36, he continues, but concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father only. For as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark. And they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two men will be in the field, one taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken, and the other will be left. Jesus tells us, we don't know when this is going to happen. It's going to be sudden, like a thief in the night, he says. And it's true, but I will also tell you and warn you, over the years, there have been no shortage of people trying to figure it out, when it will happen, the day it will happen, trying to write books on the prophecy and their idea of when the end times will be and when the rapture will occur. In 2012, the Mayan calendar was supposed to end the world. You remember that? It didn't. We're still here. In 1992, a man named Harold Camping said that the world was going to end precisely on May 21st of 2011. It was a date that he had calculated to be exactly 7,000 years after the flood. Well, on May 22nd of 2011, everyone was still around, he went, oh, I must have made a counting error. It's actually going to be October. Well, then October came and went, and he kind of disappeared because he was wrong. Do you remember December 31st, 1999? Y2K? It's going to end the world, wasn't it? The banks were going to all go belly up. The calendars were all going to stop working. The airplanes were going to fall out of the sky. The satellites were going to fall down from space. The sun was going to blow up. I don't know what else was going to happen, but it wasn't going to be good. And then 12:01, and we're all waiting. The lights are still on. Computers are still working. In 1970, a Harvard professor by the name of George Wald said that life, he was confident, would be over in 15 years. Also in 1970, it was a popular year, they said that by the year 2000, there would be a global ice age due to global cooling. Think about that. All wrong, and they continue to be, because no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. Here's the thing about that. If we knew when, we'd get ready like the day before. If we knew that all of this wouldn't happen for another 1,000 years, there'd be no urgency now. There'd be no preaching. There'd be no evangelism. There'd be no kingdom building. There'd be no outreach. There'd be no missionaries. There would be no one doing these things because we'd say, well, you know what? That's going to be their problem. That happens in 1,000 years. So in like 980 years, we'll start. But for right now, we're just going to hang out. It's a story of the rich fool from Luke 12. He had the same idea. He had more than he would ever need for a lifetime. He stored it up, and what did he say? Eat, drink, and be merry. You've got more than you'll ever need. And then one day God says, but tonight your soul is required of you. Could you imagine if the world knew the day and the hour? If we knew that Jesus was coming on Friday, well, we'd start on Thursday. And so Jesus says, no one knows. Instead, you know what he says? Have urgency. He says, go into the world and preach the gospel. That word go, again, not in English, but in Greek, does not mean get up and go. You know what it means? It means as you're going through life, it's a constant, ongoing, future infinitive in the language. And it means that as you're going through life, every single day be doing this. It says, make disciples of the whole world, of all the nations, teaching them. He says, I'm returning. I'm with you. He tells us in another place, work while day is here because night is coming and no one will work. And so the second coming will be unmistakable. It will be unavoidable. It will be universal. It will be undeniable. It will be unpredictable. We're not going to know when. No one knows the day or the hour. So what's the takeaway? What does that mean for us? What if this isn't for 1,000 years? And also keep in mind that the church is gone. We're raptured out of this whole thing. These are the believers that have come to faith after the rapture. They're in the middle of the tribulation. What does this mean for us? Only this: be undeterrable. Don't flinch. Don't get complacent. Don't get discouraged. Notice in verse 42, he goes on, therefore, stay awake. You do not know on what day your Lord is coming, but know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you must also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Jesus said in Revelation 3, hold fast to what you have so that no one can seize your crowns. In Proverbs chapter 1, it says, the simple are killed by their turning away, and complacency of fools is what destroys them. The point is, in all of that, don't be deterred. Be undeterrable. Don't let the world convince you that all of this is nonsense. Don't let people discourage you. Don't let your guard down. Don't let the fact that we're waiting let you get distracted. You know, we tell our kids sometimes, wait right here. That lasts about 2.5 milliseconds, and they're gone. Jesus says, be ready. Stay awake. Verse 42, you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. He says later in verse 50, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he does not know. And so be ready. If Jesus returned for his church right now, what do you think he would find? If he walked into your life right now, what would he find? Maybe you think back to the days when you first became a believer and you were on fire. I mean, you were in church every week. You were in church twice a week. You were in a small group. You were serving. You were witnessing to the people in your office. You were talking to your neighbor and your family. You became that person that people would go the other way because you were coming down the street with a Bible, and Thanksgiving dinner became kind of weird because you were talking about Jesus the whole time and the family was kind of awkward about it. And you think back to those days and the fire and the passion that you had. And then think forward to where we are now. What would Jesus find if he came right this moment? He said he'd be back. Are we ready? Father, I pray that we would be. I pray that each and every one of us, as we think of these things, that this would give us a sense of urgency about the return of Jesus. I pray that this would give us an urgency about sharing what we've heard and what we know and what he's told us to be ready for. Because, Lord, there are so many people in the world who do not know. They've heard, but they don't get it. They haven't grasped on to the whole thing, or maybe they've dismissed it all entirely. But, Lord, there is a day, and it is coming. And night is coming when no one would work. And so, Father, I pray that we would stay alert and on guard. I pray that the urgency in our hearts would continue to share with the world, with people who will have heard, but do they understand? I pray, Lord, that we'd keep this true in our own lives, that an urgency of maintaining, that it would be there. I pray that we wouldn't let ourselves get distracted. I pray that we would keep our eye on the prize. And I pray, Lord, that you would use us to share these things with others with the same passion and urgency that Jesus has shared it with us. We do not know the day or the hour. It could be today. So, Father, I pray that we would be ready. And I pray that we would do the work of making the world ready. And I pray, Lord, that you would give us grace and mercy and protection as we do these things through our preaching, through the way that we witness, through the way we live our lives, that we would remind the world that Jesus is coming. And it is in his name we pray. Amen.